This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Since You Asked is a specialty show that includes articles and columns on advice, commentary, and opinion. This program is funded by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. Views expressed in this program are those of the authors or publications and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or its volunteer readers. My name is Alita, and I am your volunteer reader. Our first article today is Carolyn Hacks from the May 3rd, 2026 Washington Post. Dear Carolyn, my father-in-law is in a rehab facility recovering from surgery. He's not adjusting well. I've been encouraging our twin sons, 21, to visit their grandfather, even mapping out the bus route for them from their university. But so far, they've only gone with us right after his surgery. This week, my husband told me his dad is still depressed, so I said he should take our boys to visit. To my surprise, he said he'd texted our daughter about it several times and was disappointed she blew him off. My daughter doesn't have much of a relationship with her grandfather because he was never interested in her. My father-in-law was overjoyed when we had the twins, even thanking my husband for finally giving him grandsons. My husband and his brother defended their father, saying he'd only had boys and couldn't relate to girls. Over the years, he took the boys on frequent outings, but never our daughter or our niece. My mother-in-law made up for it when she was alive, but after her death, I actually had to tell my father-in-law that he couldn't just give birthday and Christmas gifts to the boys. It was either all or none. When I asked my husband why he expected our daughter to visit his dad, but not our sons, he got defensive, saying she was 3 years older and has a car. When I reminded them she works long hours over an hour away from the facility, he said that girls are just better at this kind of thing. I was shocked to hear such sexism from my husband. I called him on it, and he said he couldn't believe I was piling on when he's so upset about his dad. I dropped it after he promised to stop bugging our daughter, but I feel like we need to revisit this in the future. Am I right, or should I chalk it all up to stress? Signed, Shocked. Shocked. If your daughter could have a word, then I expect she would like you to revisit this in the past. 21 years ago, to be exact, when your husband grabbed an opinion off the men's room floor to excuse her demotion to second-class grandchild. Couldn't relate to girls. Brain trash. Your husband said this. Since it was in reference to the emotional sclerosis you call a father-in-law, maybe you gave your husband a pass? But he had a wide, obstacle-free moral path to embracing his girl's full humanity in 2005, not in 1905, and he didn't take it. He didn't say to his father, "Daughter is my joy. Twin girls would have been my joys, too." Or a tougher, "You have three grandchildren, Dad. Are we clear?" This was hardly a trench at the Somme. By your account, your husband didn't even nod to the problem when he talked to you. There was no, "Yeah, he's a dinosaur, but..." "Millions of grandpas manage, but..." "Obviously, I don't subscribe to this myself, but..." Right? Then your husband let the boys' only frequent outings happen, as did you, to be fair. Institutionalized sexism, family size. He let his mommy absorb it, then let you sort of clean up after it, after his mom died. What I want to say is, good morning. It appears two general choices await you. One is to chalk it all up to stress, and then in another 21 years or so, be shocked when your husband says the systemic part out loud again, maybe favoring your grandson this time. Or you can see right now how sexist a man has to be to sell out his own daughter to please his sexist dad, to make sure Pop-Pop can go wherever, fishing and backslapping with the grandsons he actually wanted, and to this day blame you for piling on. Shocking as hell, I'll give you that. I will also grant, deep breath, how hard things are for any of us to see when we're in them. But you see it now. So give your shock the revisit it deserves. Let your daughter know you put a stop to this latest outrage, and apologies in hand, start the conversation about the ones you missed. Settle in. Let your sons know you're not proud you okayed the whole separate but unequal plan from which they profited for decades. Your means of redress is telling the truth. They're 21, it's time, and paroling their sister from Grandpa. Use this episode as the entry point to talk with each son about unseen privilege. As you drive one at a time, perhaps, to visit his grandfather, car rides are great for this. Let your husband know that when he sells his daughter out cheap to benefit himself and the grandpa who neglected her, the biggest problem isn't his mood when he does it. Sweet mother of dogs, his dumping on her when he's upset is more problematic, not less, because that means it's a reflex, automatic, wired. So, yeah, settle in. Next, from the May 3rd, 2026 Washington Post, Asking Eric, by R. Eric Thomas. Can I ask my billionaire cousin to share her money? A wealthy cousin has never offered any money to the letter writer. What's the best way to ask her to start sharing? Dear Eric, I am one of six cousins in a family that has been relatively close over the years as we share birthdays, weddings, and holidays together quite frequently. There's another cousin who is part of the other side of the family that is not only ultra-rich, billionaire, but has mostly kept her distance from us over the years. This other cousin is now in her mid-70s and has always enjoyed a very luxurious life due to the business success of her father, my uncle, and our grandfather. I respect her hard work in their family's business, but have always been amazed how they never really shared any of their wealth to help out the rest of the family. My father passed unexpectedly at 46, and my mother raised three of us on her own, working an office job. We never went hungry, but looking back, I'm shocked my uncle didn't help her much at all. I would now like to contact my cousin, whom I haven't seen in more than 20 years, and see if she'd consider setting up a trust for my three children and the children of my other cousins. I realize I have no rights to this money, but would like my children to get some help as they grow their families. My other cousins think I'm wasting my time asking, but I figure it can't hurt to ask. What's the best way to go about approaching my cousin with this request? Signed, Family Generosity. Family. It's an audacious ask, to be sure, but you're right that it probably can't hurt, since the worst she can say is no, and it doesn't seem you have contact with her otherwise. But consider approaching your cousin as you would a stranger or a charitable organization. Make your case, even if the case is simply, I am trying every avenue in hopes of helping my children have better futures. Presenting this ask as part of a familial obligation doesn't quite sit right. There is residual hurt and confusion about why your uncle didn't help your family, and you likely have similar feelings about why the cousin hasn't volunteered any of her riches. But try to put that aside if you can. You're not going to get far by suggesting that she owes the family. Relationships are two-way streets. It's sad for both sides that she hasn't been involved with the family. If you're going to ask for money, think about what kind of relationship you want to offer her. Otherwise, she'll likely feel she's just being used as an ATM. Dear Eric, I move often, roughly every 3.5 years on average. I always introduce myself to my new neighbors and often exchange numbers with them. This comes in handy because some of us have elderly parents, we almost all have pets, and sometimes the unexpected happens. Most recently, I tried exchanging numbers with my very friendly next-door neighbor, whom I've been living next to for 2 years. I had my other next-door neighbor's number, but not his. I left a note in his mailbox with mine and my husband's number, saying we should have each other's contact info in case of an emergency. Next time I saw him, I asked if he received my note, but he seemed very flustered and said, "I'm really busy right now." I said, "Okay, just call or text me whenever." He never contacted me. Now, this previously very friendly guy completely avoids me, doesn't look at me, doesn't say hi, and even if he notices I'm outside, it seems he goes back inside and waits for me to go away before he comes back out. I've literally never had this experience with anyone. What is going on? Signed, Perplexed Neighbor. Neighbor, I can't say for sure, but it's possible he might have misconstrued your intentions. That doesn't seem like any fault of yours, but it could have changed things for him. He also might be uncomfortable giving out his personal information and equally uncomfortable communicating his boundary. Or he may not want to be involved in someone else's emergency should it arise. This does put him at a disadvantage should he need assistance, but that's his choice. If you want to try to mend fences, the best recourse might be another note. I know, another note could make an awkward situation more awkward, but hopefully it clears the air. You could write, "I worry I've offended you by asking to exchange numbers. I meant no disrespect. We often do it with neighbors, but it's not a requirement. I'd love to go back to being able to greet each other. Feel free to disregard the last request. That said, if you anticipate moving again, as is your cadence, you may just want to let it be." Next, from the May 2nd, 2026 New York Times, Ask the Ethicist, by Kwame Anthony Appiah. A homeless person's pet needed help. Should I have tried to buy it? I could tell that the man loved his cat, but also that he was unable to provide care for it. This past winter, I was walking through downtown Chicago on a frigid night when I encountered a homeless man and his pet cat. I felt sad for both, but the cat seemed especially pitiful. The man was bundled up and in good spirits, but the cat looked miserable. She was leashed to a milk crate, had only a thin blanket, and wore a light-up sombrero. I stopped to talk to the man, who was friendly, and to pet the cat, who was shut down and shivering and didn't respond to being touched. From our brief conversation, I could tell that the man loved his cat, but also that he was mentally ill and unable to provide proper care for the animal. I gave him some money, said good night, and walked on. Now, months later, I can't stop thinking about them, especially the cat. I realize I sound more empathetic toward the cat than the person, but of the two of them, she seemed far the worse off. Would it have been inappropriate to offer the man money for his beloved pet, promising to find her a warm, loving home? Taking the cat might have eased her suffering, but it would have forced the man to choose between money and the animal he loves. It might also reward him for mistreating the cat, and he could find another animal and repeat the pattern. How should I have handled this? Name withheld. From the ethicist. Whoever offers to another a bargain of any kind proposes to do this. Give me that which I want, and you shall have this which you want, Adam Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations. A successful exchange, he was saying, is to the advantage of each party. But when one side is acting out of desperation, it can be fairly deemed to be exploitive. It's true that people constantly do things for money they wouldn't otherwise do. That's basically what work is. But there's a difference between a person in dire circumstances driven to sell an organ and a corporate manager who's showing up only for the paycheck. To decide whether a transaction is exploitive, we ask a bundle of questions about how constrained someone's options are, whether what's being given up is inherently invasive or violative of this person, whether someone has the capacity to understand what's being given up, whether the loss is irreversible, and how difficult refusal would be. All of which is to say that you were right to be uncomfortable about the exchange you were contemplating. You raise two further concerns. First, that accepting the offer would reward the mistreatment that prompted it. But the man surely wasn't in the business of acquiring pets in order to sell them, and you don't doubt that he loved the cat. So there's no marketplace in animal suffering that you'd be sustaining. You also worry that he would find another animal and repeat the cycle. There are indeed vast numbers of unsheltered animals out there. But that's a problem of a different order and scale, one that requires another set of strategies and institutions. It's not a reason to leave this particular animal in the cold. Your impulse to help this creature was a decent one. It's just that you had ways to do so without leveraging the man's hardship. One would be to do exactly what you did, give him money outright as a gift. There are also organizations like the ASPCA and nonprofits specifically devoted to the animals of unsheltered people that exist for these situations. A call from you might have brought in people with both expertise and resources to help this man keep his cat warm and provide medical attention if needed. Neither of these options requires anyone to surrender anything. On that frigid night, you came across two vulnerable beings, not one. The challenge was to find a way to do right by both. And now, Miss Manners, from the May 4th, 2026 Washington Post, by Judith Martin, Nicholas Martin, and Jacobina Martin. Are graduation invitations just gift requests? Letter writer and daughter disagree about what a graduation invitation means. Dear Miss Manners, my daughter and I have a disagreement regarding graduation invitations. She has stated that sending an invitation means you are expecting a gift, so it is therefore acceptable not to send the invitation. I believe it is an opportunity to celebrate a major milestone in the life of the graduate with family and friends. I do not think this means you have to bring a gift, and I think it is wrong to presume one's financial capabilities. It is a time of celebrating. Gentle reader, how nice that you are an idealist. How fortunate that your daughter is a realist. It would indeed be sweet if relatives and friends received graduation invitations and thought, wow, Jillian is graduating, and we'll get to see her receive her diploma. And if there's a party involved, the excitement would be about basking in Jillian's glory, or just enjoying any excuse for a party. Maybe grandmama would react this way. Maybe even a neighbor who watched her grow up. But your daughter is right that people do regard such invitations as bills. Graduation ceremonies are tedious to any but those with the strongest ties and attachments to a graduate. Even people who might enjoy a party are thinking, what's the going rate for graduation presents these days? And if we don't go, do we still have to send something? Of course you are proud of your daughter's achievement. When you tell your friends about it, no doubt they will be pleased for you. But Miss Manners suggests that you listen to your daughter and not expect them to be as deeply involved as you are. One way to recognize her achievement is to respect her analysis of the situation. Dear Miss Manners, I received a graduation announcement for a second cousin whom I have never met. Am I obliged to send a gift? Gentle reader, no, but sending congratulations would be nice. Dear Miss Manners, a Mother's Day question regarding mothers who work for us. I have 10 employees who are mothers. Is it appropriate to get a small token of appreciation for all 10 on Mother's Day, or only the ones who would be working that day? Gentle reader, this would be a good way to sow dissension among your employees. Miss Manners suspects that many would be miffed, not only the mothers absent that day, but also, and perhaps especially, the non-parents who are gracious about concessions made to parents when their personal duties conflict with work. Dear Miss Manners, my children are college students with no income and very little money in the bank. I do not want them to spend a lot of their money for Mother's Day. They always spend too much, and it really stresses me out. Also, my husband always ignores my request not to buy me any flowers. I would prefer that they just get me a jar of my favorite lotion, which is under $10. Would that be rude to suggest? And how can I do it in a tactful manner? Gentle reader, by thanking them and seeming to be delighted with their choices, and especially by refraining from criticizing and attempting to take control over their generous gestures. Miss Manners considers scorning tributes to be a sure way of killing the spirit that inspired them. Dear Miss Manners, I have some friends who frequently announce to me how much money they are saving by shopping at discount stores, buying off-brand items, and buying all of their clothing, including shoes, at second-hand and thrift stores. I am not wealthy, but I am a professional who works hard. I do not shop at these stores because whenever I have tried in the past, I am not satisfied. I don't wear or use the items and end up feeling that I have truly wasted money instead of saving it. Whether something is expensive is subjective, isn't it? I do not ever brag or tell anyone what I pay for anything. It is one thing to make a general comment about good shopping places, but when one of my friends starts telling me the exact dollar and cents difference, I can't respond. She will continue to repeat how much she saves as though she wants me to agree, which I usually don't. For example, a friend announced she couldn't buy a bag of chocolate chips at the grocery store. I thought it might be an interesting story, but she proceeded to say she was so spoiled by the prices at such and such discount store, she just could not make the purchase elsewhere. Most of the time I have no response, but I did laugh at this one and say, "You must not have wanted them very badly." Occasionally I'll say, "Well, good for you." Most of the time I just ignore the discussion, but it always feels awkward. Isn't it just as rude to constantly talk about penny pinching as it is to brag about how much money one spends? Gentle reader, it is not quite the same, but Miss Manners agrees with you that is certainly no more interesting. Dear Miss Manners, would you please ask everyone to avoid completing someone else's sentence unless you're a close friend of the speaker, understand the circumstances, and know the context of what they're saying? When someone does this to me, I bite my tongue and have the urge to say, if you are telepathic, then we don't even have to continue this conversation at all. But I've outgrown the urge to be sarcastic. Gentle reader, that is a relief. Miss Manners will reward you by spreading the word, although she will warn you against giving close friends and even partners and family members your exemption. They can be equally bad at predicting the ends of your sentences, and even more infuriating if they get it wrong. And that's it for today. You have been listening to articles and advice columns from our program, Since You Asked. This show is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Alita. I'll be with you again next week. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bird Note. Bird beaks, or bills, come in many shapes and sizes, and birds use them for just about everything. To collect food, to preen, fight, court, chop holes in trees, weave nests, and more. But in order for a bird to fly, its beak must weigh as little as possible. So beaks have evolved to be ultra-light, like birds' hollow bones and feathers. Just what is this versatile appendage made of? At its core, both upper and lower halves of a beak contain light, bony projections that extend from the skull. These bony parts are covered with a sheath of a tough material called keratin. It's the same stuff that makes up tortoise shells, the scales and claws of reptiles, and our own hair and fingernails. The keratin sheath makes the beak tough, durable, and shiny. The sheath grows continuously because a beak wears down with use. Picture a shorebird, like this black oyster catcher, flipping rocks and hammering shells all day. Ancient birds were weighed down with jaws and teeth, making flight far more challenging. But the beak of a modern bird, whether it belongs to an eagle, toucan, or hummingbird, is a marvel fit for life on the wing. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl-blind-seniors.org.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, hey Google, Play Radio Station Audio Journal on TuneIn.